This deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. If you're gearing up for the Series 82, they've got a full course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com.
Sounds like a pretty good deal, honestly.
Right. I mean, it's super helpful. But anyway, imagine you are sitting at your desk, you're about to launch a $1 billion offering for a client, you're feeling good, and you draft a quick email to your contact list. You don't mention a price. You don't attach a document. You don't even explicitly ask for money. You just write, you know, big news coming in the tech sector next week. Keep your eyes peeled. And you hit send.
And just like that, you have committed a massive federal securities violation. Like, your deal is frozen. Your firm is facing crippling fines. Mm-hmm. And your compliance officer is marching down the hallway right now to pack up your desk.
Welcome to another deep dive. Today, we are navigating the incredibly treacherous waters of offering communications and research safe harbors. Honestly, the most accurate way to understand federal securities law is to treat it like a high-stakes game of the floor is lava.
Yeah, the lava in this regulatory universe is an illegal, unregistered offer. If you even breathe on the lava, the Securities and Exchange Commission will burn you. But scattered across this sea of molten lava are a few tiny, highly specific regulatory couches you can jump on to survive. And those are your safe harbors.
But you have to know exactly where those couches are. I mean, you have to know their exact dimensions, and you have to know who is legally allowed to stand on them. If your foot hangs off the edge by a single inch.
Lava. Exactly. Which is why this topic isn't just regulatory trivia. We are drawing the absolute line between a routine, legally compliant deal announcement and a career-ending violation. If you're preparing for the Series 82 exam, this specific area covers 2 scored items within Function 1.
Which is huge, right?
Oh, yeah. That makes up 50% of the exam weight for that section. The examiners are obsessed with this because the real-world stakes are astronomical.
So to keep us from falling into the lava today and to make sure we don't just drown in legal textbook jargon, we're going to filter all of these rules through a recurring cast of characters. We have 3 people you really need to keep in your head.
Right. So first up is Riley the Rep.
Riley is our enthusiastic, well-meaning, registered representative who always, and I mean always, acts before he thinks. He is an innovator in his own mind and a walking compliance nightmare in reality. He basically represents every instinct you have to, like, hack the system.
Spot on. Next, we have Ingrid the Investor. So Ingrid is our high net worth client. She's got the capital. She's highly sophisticated, but she is skeptical. She doesn't just hand over a check because someone asked nicely. She needs the paperwork, she needs the proof, and she needs everything done strictly by the book.
She is not messing around. And finally, we have Sam the Sponsor. Sam manages funds. He is the ultimate marketing guy. His only goal in life is to push his financial products to the absolute maximum edge of the law. He wants his fund's name on a blimp, and he will constantly ask where the line is, just so he can put his toes right up against it.
Sam is exhausting for compliance teams. But yeah, Riley, Ingrid, and Sam are going to guide us through every single trap the SEC has laid out.
So with our cast assembled, pause for a second and ask yourself a question. Seriously, think about the answer before we keep going. Before a company even files a registration statement with the SEC, what can a firm legally say out loud about an upcoming deal? Like, what is the baseline?
Well, the baseline is silence. Total silence. If a registration statement hasn't been filed, you are in the quiet period. Any communication that conditions the market or hypes up the issuer is an illegal offer. Unless, of course, you find a safe harbor.
Okay, let's start with the easiest way to ruin a deal. Let's look at Riley the Rep trying to sell a private placement. He's sitting at his desk. He's looking at his phone. He thinks, you know, it's 2026. The world is digital. I'm not going to cold call people one by one like it's 1985. I'm just going to blast an email to 10,000 people and throw the private offering documents up on a public webpage.
Yeah, Riley is walking face first into the general solicitation trap. It's bad.
But wait, break down the actual rule here, because if I look at the text of Regulation D, which is the rule governing private placements, it explicitly lists things like newspapers, magazines, and television broadcasts as forms of general solicitation. If you use those, you ruin the private exemption because you broadcast it to the general public. But I'm reading the text, and it doesn't mention websites. It doesn't mention email blasts. So didn't Riley just find an internet loophole?
He absolutely did not. And this is a massive point of confusion for people studying the law. The fact that the 1930s era text, or even the later Regulation D text, doesn't explicitly define open websites as general solicitation will not save him in an audit. Not even a little bit.
Why not? I mean, if it's not in the rule, how can they punish him?
Because of SEC staff guidance. The SEC doesn't just write a rule and walk away. They issue interpretive guidance on how they're going to enforce that rule in the modern world. And the staff guidance has made it aggressively clear. Electronic does not mean safer. The medium changed, but the legal analysis did not.
This is exactly where the exam tries to get you. I guarantee people mess this up because their intuition tells them an email feels more private than a newspaper. Like it lands in an individual inbox. But the SEC is saying an untargeted email blast to 10,000 people is legally indistinguishable from taking out a full-page ad in the Wall Street Journal.
Exactly. And an open, unrestricted website is treated exactly like renting a giant billboard in Times Square. Both of them condition the market for the offering. Both of them hit an unrestricted audience. The instant Riley hits send on that massive email blast or publishes that open web page, he turns his private deal into a general solicitation. The private exemption evaporates, and the floor turns to lava.
Okay, so Riley gets a terrifying phone call from his compliance department. They scream at him. He takes the website down. He says, fine, you want restrictions? I'll give you restrictions. He goes back into the code, and he slaps a password screen on his portal. The password is Series 82 Rocks. He hands that password out to literally everyone he emails. He even puts a little checkbox on the login screen that says, I certify I am a wealthy, accredited investor.
Is he safe now? I mean, he built a wall.
That wall is made of paper, and he is still in the lava. A portal is not just a password. Password alone does not magically cure a general solicitation.
But why? He restricted access. You literally need the password to get in. Because the SEC staff guidance laid out a very specific, sequential, chronological arrangement for how these restricted portals have to work. The order of operations is absolutely critical. If you mess up the sequence, the password means nothing.
Oh, wow. Okay, walk me through the exact sequence, step by step.
Okay, step one. Riley the rep must evaluate the prospective investor. Let's bring in Ingrid the investor. Riley has to look at Ingrid and determine affirmatively that she is an accredited or sophisticated investor. He has to do the heavy lifting to qualify her first.
First. So before she sees a single deal, before she gets a password, before she even knows what Riley is selling.
Precisely. You have to vet her. Step two. Ingrid formally opens an account with Riley's broker-dealer.
Okay, so she is qualified and she is a client. What is step three?
Step three. Ingrid is finally granted access to the password-protected portal. But here is the critical limitation. She can only view and buy into offerings that are posted to that restricted site after she was qualified and opened her account.
Wait, pause. You're saying if Sam, the sponsor, gave Riley a private deal on Monday and Riley put it on the portal on Tuesday, and then Ingrid gets qualified and opens her account on Wednesday, she can't buy the Monday deal.
She cannot touch it. It's off limits to her.
Why? She's qualified. She's rich. She has an account. What does it matter when the deal was posted?
Think about the philosophy of the rule. The SEC wants to prove that you are not using the internet to broadcast an offering to the general public. If a deal is already sitting on the shelf, waiting behind a digital door, and you go out into the world, find a random person, qualify them, and immediately let them walk through the door to buy that specific deal, you essentially marketed that specific deal to the public. You just used a brief qualification process as a speed bump.
Oh, wow. I never thought about it like that.
Right. But if you qualify Ingrid on Wednesday and a brand new deal from Sam the sponsor arrives on Friday, you clearly didn't use the Friday deal to bait her into the portal on Wednesday. The relationship predated the offering. The order of operations proves the integrity of the exemption.
That is fascinating. The sequence is the proof. Okay, let's get back to something Riley did on his fake wall. He put up a checkbox that said, I certify I am accredited. Let's say Riley hasn't actually done any background work on Ingrid. He doesn't know her net worth. But Ingrid clicks that self-certification checkbox, types in the password, and tries to execute a trade. Does that work?
It completely fails. And this brings us to the core concept of the pre-existing substantive relationship. That phrase is your golden ticket for private electronic offerings. You need a pre-existing relationship, which we just proved with the chronological sequence, but it also must be substantive.
What elevates a relationship to substantive in the eyes of the SEC? Like, what's the bar?
It means the firm has gathered and actually used enough detailed financial information to evaluate the investor's circumstances. A self-certification checkbox gives the firm zero actual data. It's completely useless.
Right. It's the difference between me asking you, hey, are you a safe driver, and you saying yes, versus me pulling your DMV record, seeing you haven't had a ticket in 10 years, checking your insurance, and putting you through a road test. One is a checkbox. The other is substantive.
Exactly. If the SEC audits Riley, they're going to ask, Why did you think this highly illiquid, risky private startup was a suitable investment for Ingrid? If Riley says, well, she clicked a box on my website, the SEC will fine him into oblivion. He must be able to produce the financial analysis he did before showing her the deal.
Okay, I need to do a hard pattern interrupt right here. Hey, wake up. Are you listening? Make sure you process this next point, because the examiners love to prey on this exact confusion. We just talked about private placements. Every rule we are about to discuss for the rest of this deep dive, tombstones, proposed offer notices, generic advertising, research safe harbors, all of them belong to registered offerings.
Yeah, that is a fatal flaw for so many test takers. You absolutely cannot take a registered offering safe harbor and use it as a shield for a private deal.
Seriously. If you see a test question where Riley tries to run a generic TV commercial or publish a tombstone ad to drum up interest for an unregistered private placement, the answer is always that it's a violation. The general solicitation rules we just covered control private deals. You cannot borrow a couch from the registered side of the lava pit and drag it over to the private side.
It will sink immediately. The SEC built those safe harbors specifically for deals that undergo the massive, rigorous disclosure process of a full SEC registration. Private deals don't have that transparency, so they don't get the marketing privileges.
Perfect. So Riley has been thoroughly chastised. He understands his internet boundaries for private deals. Let's shift gears entirely. Let's move into the registered world. What happens when our marketing genius, Sam the sponsor, wants to hint that a massive registered deal is coming, but he hasn't actually filed the registration statement with the SEC yet?
Okay, so this is the pre-filing period. As we established earlier, the baseline rule is that you cannot offer a security before filing a registration statement, period.
But Sam wants to build buzz. He wants the market to know he's working on something big. He needs a safe harbor.
And the SEC provides one. It's called the Proposed Offering Notice Rule. It allows an issuer, a selling security holder, or a broker-dealer acting on their behalf to publish a brief notice that they plan to register an offering in the future. As long as they stay within the strict boundaries of this rule, the communication is legally classified as not an offer.
I love analogies, and the best way I've found to categorize this specific rule is to think of it as a wedding save the date.
Oh, I like that. Walk me through the mechanics of that.
Well, when you receive a save the date card in the mail, what does it actually tell you? It gives you the names of the couple, and it gives you a rough time frame like fall 2027, but it doesn't give you the venue address. It doesn't tell you what time the ceremony starts. It doesn't let you pick the chicken or the fish. You cannot RSVP to a save the day. It is purely a heads up to keep the time frame on your radar.
That maps brilliantly to the regulatory restrictions of the proposed offering notice. Because the most important restriction, the absolute biggest ban you need to memorize, is that this notice can never name the underwriters.
Why is naming the underwriter the ultimate sin here? If Riley is underwriting the deal, why can't Sam just say that? It's a true fact.
Because of what an underwriter represents to the market. An underwriter is the distribution engine. If Sam just says, my company is planning to issue stock next year, that's a corporate update. But if Sam says, my company is planning to issue stock next year and Goldman Sachs is the underwriter, the market immediately translates that as, the sales team is assembled, the machinery is turned on, call your broker at Goldman now to get in line.
So naming the underwriter turns it from a factual corporate update into an implicit sales pitch. It initiates the marketing process.
Exactly. So this is where the exam tries to get you. If you are reading a question about a pre-filing communication, and it mentions that the lead underwriter is named in the document, you instantly know the safe harbor is blown. You are not looking at a proposed offering notice, period.
Okay, so Sam is drafting his save the date. He leaves Riley's firm off the notice entirely. What is he actually allowed to include? Let's deduce this rather than just reading a list.
First, he has to include a protective shield. Every single notice under this rule requires a specific legend stating that the communication does not constitute an offer of any securities for sale.
That's the legal disclaimer. This is not an invitation. You cannot RSVP.
Right. Now, what basic facts would the market actually need to know to make the notice useful?
Well, they need to know who is doing the offering. So the issuer's name.
Yes.
They need to know what is being sold. Are we talking about debt or equity? So the title, amount, and basic terms of the securities.
Correct. And if current shareholders are selling their stock instead of the company issuing new stock, you can include the amount being offered by those selling security holders.
They need the when, the anticipated timing of the offer, and maybe the why. Like, why are they raising money?
Yeah, a brief statement of the manner and purpose of the offering. And finally, whether the offering targets a particular class of purchasers, like if it's only for current employees, plus any statements required by state or foreign law, that is the core list. It is short and it is strictly limited.
Okay, but let's test the boundaries of this. Let's say Sam, the sponsor, is doing a rights offering. For anyone who might be rusty, walk me through exactly what a rights offering physically is. Because if I don't understand the mechanism of the transaction, I'm just going to be memorizing a random list of permitted items.
Sure. So a rights offering is when a company gives its current shareholders the right to buy additional shares of new stock, usually at a discount, before that stock is offered to the general public. The purpose is to let current shareholders maintain their proportional ownership so they don't get diluted.
Okay, so if I own 1% of the company, a rights offering lets me buy enough new shares to ensure I still own 1% after the massive new issuance.
Precisely. Now think about the mechanics of that. If Sam publishes a basic proposed offering notice that just says, "We are doing a rights offering next month," that is fundamentally useless to the current shareholders.
Right, because my first question as a shareholder is going to be, how many new shares do I get to buy for every old share I own? And what is the cutoff date to own the stock to get this privilege?
Exactly. You just deduced the exceptions. Because certain transactions require specific structural data just to be comprehensible, the SEC allows you to add specific items for specific deals. For a rights offering, you are allowed to add the eligible class of security holders, the subscription ratio and price, the record date, which is that cutoff date you mentioned, and the anticipated issuance date of the rights.
It makes logical sense. You can't announce a rights offering without telling people the ratio and the record date. Let's do another one. What if Sam is doing an employee offering? What's the fundamental piece of information an employee needs?
An employee needs to know who the employer is, which class of employees is eligible, like, is this just for executives or everyone? What the offering price is and the time frame they have to decide. The SEC allows all of that for an employee offering.
Okay, what if it's an exchange offer where a company says, give us your old bonds and we'll give you these new different bonds?
You can include the basic terms of the exchange, the subject company's name, and the exact class of securities being sought.
Okay, last one. What if it's a massive corporate merger and the current security holders actually have to vote to approve it before the new shares are issued? What extra info can Sam include on the notice?
This one requires the most detail. You can include the name of the company whose assets are being sold, the names of the other parties involved, a brief description of their businesses, a brief description of the transaction itself, and crucially, because it requires a vote, the date, time, and place of that vote.
Okay, so Riley the rep is helping Sam draft this proposed offering notice. Sam is doing a standard offering. Riley types it all out, publishes it, and then realizes he made a typo. He accidentally wrote that the offering is happening in Q3 instead of Q4. Because he is Riley, he panics. Can he publish a correction?
He can publish a follow-up notice, yes. But here's the trap. That follow-up is strictly surgically limited to correcting the specific inaccuracies he previously published.
So if the board of directors met the next day and changed the fundamental purpose of the offering, Riley cannot use the correction notice as an excuse to update the market on the new purpose.
Never. The correction notice is an eraser, not a megaphone. If you try to piggyback new, unpermitted information onto a correction, you lose the safe harbor immediately.
Good to know. One more thing on these pre-filing notices. Do they ever actually have to be filed with the SEC? Because the whole point is that we are in the pre-filing stage of the registration statement.
For standard offerings, no. But there is a massive exception that the exam loves. If the notice relates to a business combination transaction like that merger requiring a vote we just discussed, it must be filed with the SEC.
Wait, even if it perfectly follows all the content rules?
Yes. The permitted content list and the filing duty are two completely separate regulatory requirements. You can draft a flawless merger notice that stays right on the safe harbor couch, but if you fail to file it with the SEC, you sink into the lava.
Okay, let's keep marching down the timeline. We survived at the pre-filing stage. Sam successfully sent out his save the date. 6 months pass, and the lawyers finally finish their paperwork. The registration statement is officially filed with the SEC.
Yes, we have officially crossed the Rubicon.
We have. We are upgrading from the save the date to the formal invitation. Welcome to the Tombstone Communication.
This is a seismic shift in what you're legally allowed to say.
Mm-hmm.
A tombstone communication only protects a statement that goes out after a registration statement has been filed.
Let's do a direct side-by-side comparison because the examiners will absolutely test your ability to tell these two apart.
Oh, definitely. It's the most reliable way to spot the trick.
Okay. Proposed offering notice. Pre-filing. Tombstone communication. Post-filing. Proposed offering notice. Never name the underwriters. Tombstone communication. You can name the underwriters. In fact, you can detail their specific roles, like who is the lead manager and who is part of the syndicate.
And that underwriter distinction is the ultimate tell on a multiple choice question. If you are staring at a sample advertisement on the exam, and it lists Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley at the bottom, you instantly know you've moved past the pre-filing stage. You are looking at a tombstone.
So we've upgraded our invitation. What exactly is Sam the sponsor allowed to put on this formal tombstone?
It is a strict closed list of 21 permitted items.
Wait, I have the rule book open right here. The rule literally numbers its permitted items up to 22. Did you miscount?
I didn't miscount. The rule numbers up to 22, but one of the slots, item number 15, usually is explicitly marked reserved. It's an empty slot left by regulators for future use or past deletion. So there are technically only 21 items you can actively use.
A ghost rule. I love regulatory trivia like that. So what are the heavy hitters on this list of 21?
The ones you really need to recognize include the issuer's identity, a brief description of their business, the securities title and the amount being offered, the price of the security, the anticipated schedule of the offering, and of course, the underwriter's names and roles.
Let's test Riley's impulses again. Riley looks at this tombstone. It's very dry. It's very factual. He says, "This is boring. No one is going to buy this." So he adds a single sentence at the bottom. "This sector is poised for massive growth. Get in early." Or he attaches a small bar chart showing how a similar company's stock doubled last year. What happens?
The entire safe harbor detonates.
Just for one sentence?
Yes, just one sentence. The list of 21 items is closed. It is exhaustive. It is not a list of suggestions. If Riley includes a performance claim, a projection, or a recommendation to buy, he doesn't just get a slap on the wrist for that one sentence. The presence of that sentence infects the entire document. The communication steps off the safe harbor couch and becomes an illegal prospectus.
It's an all-or-nothing protection. Okay, what about the mandatory stuff? Does every tombstone need a legend? Because we needed one for the proposed offering notice.
This is where you have to understand the mechanics of the SEC's timeline. You file a registration statement, but it does not become effective immediately. It sits there while the SEC reviews it. You cannot actually sell the stock until the SEC declares it effective.
So there's like a purgatory period. It's filed, but not live.
Exactly. If Sam publishes his tombstone during that purgatory period filed, but not yet effective, he must include a pre-effective legend.
And what does that legend communicate to Ingrid the investor?
It tells her two critical things. First, that a registration statement has been filed but is not yet effective. And second, that these securities cannot be sold and no offers to buy can be accepted until that effective date arrives.
Got it. It's managing expectations. We are in the system, but we can't take your money yet. But what happens after the SEC finally calls and says, "You're greenlit, the registration is effective"? Does the legend drop off?
Yes. Once it is effective, the pre-effective legend is no longer required because it's no longer true.
Yeah.
But UT, and pay close attention here, whether the registration is effective or not, a tombstone almost always requires a prospectus contact.
What exactly is a prospectus contact?
It is the name and address of a person or entity from whom the investor can obtain the full, massive, legally compliant written prospectus.
Okay, pause for a second. Ask yourself how the examiners will weaponize this timeline. They will write a question that says, "The SEC has declared the registration statement effective. Therefore, the tombstone communication no longer needs to include the name and address of the prospectus contact. True or false?"
False. That is a classic trap. They are trying to conflate the pre-effective legend with the prospectus contact. The legend disappears when effective. The prospectus contact requirement persists basically forever.
Are there any exceptions where you don't need the prospectus contact?
Only two very narrow ones. The first is if the communication is just a skeletal directory, literally just naming the security, the price, who executes orders, and from whom a prospectus can be obtained. Wait, that actually still requires the contact. The real exception is if the tombstone is physically accompanied or preceded by the full prospectus itself. If you hand them the document, you obviously don't need to tell them where to go find it.
That makes perfect logical sense. Which brings me to a huge question. Let's say Riley is sitting across the table from Ingrid. He slides this tombstone communication across the table to her. Can Riley look her in the eye and ask for an order right then and there? Can he say, "Ingrid, here is the tombstone. Do you want to put your name down for 10,000 shares?
He can, but T, only under very specific conditions. A tombstone can invite an offer to buy only if it is accompanied or preceded by the full prospectus. And, crucially, if the tombstone is asking for an order, it must carry a withdrawal statement.
What does a withdrawal statement do?
It gives Ingrid an escape hatch. It must state that no offer to buy can be accepted until the registration statement is effective, and that any offer she makes right now can be withdrawn without any obligation at any time before she receives notice of its acceptance.
Basically, Riley is saying, you can put your name on the list today, but if you wake up tomorrow in a cold sweat and change your mind before the deal goes live, you can walk away free and clear.
Exactly. It prevents the firm from locking an investor into a purchase based on a one-page summary before the full disclosures are finalized.
Let's talk about a weird exception here, because the exam loves exceptions. What if Riley isn't sending this tombstone to Ingrid? What if he sends it to another broker-dealer? Does he still need that withdrawal statement on the document?
He does not. And the logic here is based on the identity of the recipient. The SEC views retail or high net worth investors like Ingrid as needing that explicit written escape hatch so they don't feel bullied. But another dealer is a market professional. They already know the rules. They don't need the boilerplate text. So the withdrawal statement requirement drops off when communicating dealer to dealer.
Let's talk logistics. It is 2026. The rule says a tombstone can ask for an order if it is accompanied by a full prospectus. A prospectus can be 300 pages of dense legal text and financial tables. If Riley is emailing this tombstone to Ingrid, how does he accompany it? Does he have to attach a massive PDF that crashes her inbox?
He does not. The SEC updated their guidance to match reality. For an electronic communication, an active working hyperlink to the prospectus completely satisfies the accompanied by requirement.
Wow, that is incredibly convenient.
It is. A paper tombstone has to physically travel in the same envelope as the paper prospectus. An email does the exact same job by providing a one-click path to the digital document. And here's a great bonus. If you meet the condition by including that hyperlink, the SEC actually lifts the requirement for the pre-effective legend we talked about earlier, because the investor is one click away from the full, unvarnished truth.
Nice. One last boundary check on tombstones before we move to the next safe harbor. Who is actually allowed to use them? What if Sam, the sponsor, manages a massive suite of mutual funds? Can he use a tombstone for his mutual fund?
The tombstone rule has a massive carve-out for investment companies. Generally, it does not apply to a registered investment company. There is one single exception. A registered closed-end investment company can use it.
Let's define that quickly, because it explains the why. What is the fundamental difference between an open-end fund and a closed-end fund?
An open-end fund, which is what 99% of people mean when they say mutual fund, is constantly issuing new shares and redeeming old ones every single day. They are in a state of continuous distribution. A closed-end fund does one big initial public offering, issues a set number of shares, and then the doors close. Those shares just trade on an exchange.
Ah, so a closed-end fund operates much more like a traditional corporate IPO.
Exactly. Because a closed-end fund has a discrete offering period, the tombstone rule works perfectly for them. But an open-end fund is always offering shares. If they use tombstones, the market would be flooded with them every day of the year. So the SEC locks open-end funds out of the tombstone safe harbor entirely.
Keep that in your back pocket for test day. Open-end funds cannot use tombstones, period. Okay, so tombstones are hyper-specific. They are all about one specific deal on one specific date, naming the exact underwriter and giving the exact price. But what if Sam, the sponsor, doesn't want to talk about one specific deal? What if he just wants to run a national TV commercial during the Super Bowl that says, hey, bonds are great. Our firm knows bonds. You should think about adding bonds to your portfolio. Call us.
Sam is entering the realm of generic advertising. This safe harbor was built to solve a completely different marketing problem than the tombstone or the proposed offering notice.
How so?
Because generic advertising protects communications that never name a specific security at all. It's designed for type-level marketing, not product-level marketing.
So Sam is keeping it incredibly vague.
Deliberately vague. The generic advertising safe harbor allows a sponsor to advertise investment company types in general terms, like balanced funds, growth funds, income funds, or bond funds. As long as the commercial never names a specific fund or its underlying securities, the SEC will not classify that ad as an offer requiring registration.
So what exactly is Sam allowed to put in this vague Super Bowl commercial?
He can include broad explanatory information about what investment companies are and how they work. He can describe generic fund types and their general investment objectives. He can offer products and services that aren't securities subject to registration, like offering a basic financial planning consultation, as long as he isn't using it as a Trojan horse to hype a specific registered fund. And he could include an invitation to request more information.
Like putting a toll-free number or a website on the screen. Call 1-800-FUNDS to learn more.
Exactly. But the SEC always demands a trade-off. If you were going to run an ad like this, the communication must include the name and address of the sponsoring broker or dealer. And crucially, that sponsor must be a registered broker-dealer.
So you can't just be a shadowy marketing agency.
Right. Furthermore, the sponsor must actually offer for sale the type of security or service the commercial is describing. Sam cannot run an advertisement praising the virtues of municipal bond funds if his firm doesn't actually sell municipal bond funds.
Yeah, the SEC doesn't want bait-and-switch tactics.
Exactly.
Okay, I have a conditional logic question for you. This is exactly how the exam tests this material. Let's say Sam runs this generic ad for growth funds. At the end, the announcer says, "Call us to learn more." Does Sam have to include a disclosure in the commercial detailing exactly how many different growth funds his firm manages?
Think about the mechanics of the interaction. The answer is, only if the inquiry specifically triggers a prospectus mailing.
Walk me through the difference.
If the ad says, "Call to learn more," and Ingrid calls the number just to chat with a rep about what a growth fund is in the abstract, Sam does not need that disclosure in the ad. But if the structure of the ad means that calling number automatically triggers the firm to mail Ingrid a prospectus for a specific fund, then the ad itself must disclose how many investment companies are involved and whether Sam's firm is the principal underwriter or investment advisor for them.
It's conditional. The closer the ad gets to automatically putting a sales document in the investor's hand, the more disclosure the SEC demands up front.
Exactly. The SEC is constantly trying to measure the distance between the advertisement and the actual sale.
Which brings us back to our favorite topic, private placements and the general solicitation trap. Why can't a private issuer use this generic advertising rule? Why can't Riley the rep run an ad that says tech startups are great to warm up the crowd for his unregistered private tech deal?
To understand why that fails, you have to understand the underlying theory of why generic advertising is allowed for mutual funds in the first place. It is allowed for mutual funds because there's a built-in gap in the process.
A gap? Explain that.
Let's say Ingrid sees Sam's generic ad for growth funds on TV. She cannot just throw a handful of cash at the television screen to buy a growth fund in the abstract. It's impossible. The ad prompts her to call. She calls and requests more info. The firm sends her a prospectus for a specific registered fund. She reads the prospectus, and then, after all that friction, she makes an informed choice to invest. That gap, the distance between seeing the vague ad and actually purchasing a specific, fully disclosed product, is what keeps the generic ad from being classified as an illegal offer.
But with a private placement...
With a private placement, there is no SEC-mandated prospectus. There is no registered gap. If Riley runs a generic ad hyping up tech startups, he is conditioning the minds of the general public. He is whipping up excitement across an unrestricted audience, and restricting the audience is the entire foundational premise of the private offering exemption. The moment he conditions the general market, the exemption is destroyed. Boom, lava.
This circles all the way back to the warning we gave at the beginning. You cannot borrow registered offering safe harbors to cover for private deals. The mechanics are entirely incompatible. Don't fall for a scenario where Riley tries to run a vague ad for a private deal. It's always a violation. All right. Let's shift gears entirely. We've talked about email blasts, we've talked about save the dates, we've talked about tombstones and TV commercials. But we haven't talked about the most prolific content creators in the financial world.
The research departments.
Exactly. Let's look at Riley's firm. They have a massive research department. Analysts are sitting in cubicles writing detailed reports on hundreds of different companies all year long. Buy this stock, sell this stock, this sector is undervalued. But suddenly, Riley's firm is hired to be the lead underwriter for a massive registered offering for one of those exact companies. Does the research department have to drop their pens? Do they have to pretend the company doesn't exist just because the investment banking side of the firm is doing a deal?
That is the exact tension these research report safe harbors were built to resolve. A broker-dealer's research business cannot just grind to a halt every time the firm or one of its competitors underwrites a deal. The market needs continuous analysis.
But the SEC is terrified of something here,
right? Oh, absolutely. The SEC is terrified that a firm will use its independent research department as a stealth marketing arm for the investment banking department. They want to know, Are you publishing real objective analysis, or are you just hyping up the deal your firm is getting paid millions of dollars to sell?
So to thread that needle, we have three distinct safe harbors to keep the research flowing legally. But before we get into the complex differences between them, what are the baseline rules they all share?
First, they all define a research report the exact same way. It is a written communication that includes information, opinions, recommendations, or an analysis about an issuer or security.
Does it have to be a massive 50-page deep dive to count as a report?
No. It counts as a research report whether or not it actually provides a reader with enough information to base an investment decision on. If it's written analysis, it falls under the umbrella.
Okay, what is the next shared rule?
The publication or distribution of the report must occur in the regular course of the broker-dealer's business.
Let me push back on this. What does regular course actually prevent? Can Riley's firm suddenly discover a massive interest in a random biotech stock 2 days before they underwrite that biotech company's IPO?
Never. That is exactly what the rule prevents. If a research report suddenly materializes out of thin air just as the deal is launching, it is glaringly obvious that it is a one-time promotional push disguised as research. None of the safe harbors will protect it. The firm must have a historical track record of publishing research.
Okay, so the firm has to be a legitimate research house. What else do all three harbors share?
The absolute bans. None of these safe harbors are available, period, end of sentence, if the issuer of the securities is a blank check company, a shell company, or a penny stock issuer.
Let's define these so we know why the SEC hates them.
Yeah.
What is a blank check company?
A blank check company is a development stage company that has no specific business plan, or its only business plan is to engage in a merger or acquisition with an unidentified company. SPACs, special purpose acquisition companies, often fall into this territory.
Basically, give us money and we promise we'll find something cool to buy eventually.
Right. And a shell company has no or nominal operations and assets.
And a penny stock.
A highly speculative, low price security, usually trading under $5, often over the counter.
Why does the SEC ban research on these specific types of companies during an offering?
Because historically, these are the exact environments where massive pump and dump frauds occur. The SEC views them as too inherently risky and susceptible to market manipulation to allow underwriters to publish research on them during a distribution.
Okay, here's a scenario to test this. Let's say Riley is doing research on a totally clean, highly respectable tech company. Blue chip, profits, everything is great. But if you look deep into their corporate history, 2 years ago, that tech company went public by completing a reverse merger with a shady penny stock issuer. Today, they are totally clean. Can Riley use the research safe harbors for their new offering?
He and I, they're completely disqualified.
Why? I mean, the company's clean today.
Because the rule includes a 3-year look-back period, and that look-back explicitly reaches predecessors. Since the predecessor entity was a penny stock within the last 3 years, the safe harbors are off the table. The SEC does not forget.
That is a brutal trap for the exam. If the question mentions a penny stock in the company's recent history, walk away. The safe harbors are dead. Okay, so we have the baseline. Regular course of business, written analysis, no blank checks, no shells, no penny stocks, with a 3-year look back. Now we have to do a deep dive into the three specific harbors.
This is where you have to pay extremely close attention to the legal mechanics. The three safe harbors split apart based on two fundamental questions. First, is the broker-dealer actually participating in the distribution of the offering? And second, if they are participating, what exactly does the research report cover?
Let's start with harbor number one, the non-participant safe harbor.
In this scenario, Riley's firm is not participating in the distribution at all. They are not the underwriter, they are not in the syndicate, they are not selling the shares, they are completely on the outside looking in.
If they aren't participating, why do they even need a safe harbor?
Because federal law is written incredibly broadly. The definition of an underwriter can accidentally sweep in anyone who publishes information that conditions the market for a deal, even if they aren't officially hired.
So what does the rule actually do for Riley's firm?
The rule explicitly states that the words offers, participates, and participation within the legal definition of an underwriter do not apply to the publication of this report. Therefore, Riley's firm is excluded from the definition of an underwriter. they are legally walled off from the distribution.
I want to marvel at the regulatory plumbing here for a second. The rule doesn't say this report is not an offer. It explicitly says Riley's firm is not an underwriter.
Exactly. It operates on the underwriter definition. That is the specific legal mechanism. And because they are entirely removed from the underwriting process, they are free to publish research on any of the issuer's securities, and there are no extra conditions placed on the issuer beyond those shared bands we already discussed.
What if Riley's firm buys independent research from a third-party analyst and pays the regular subscription price for it? Does that count as compensation that suddenly pulls them into the deal and breaks the rule?
No. Paying the regular standard price for independent research or paying a regular subscription fee for a report does not violate the non-participant safe harbor. It is treated as a normal business expense, not underwriting compensation.
Okay, that is harbor one, non-participant mechanism. Excludes you from the underwriter definition. What is harbor number two?
Harbor number two is the different class safe harbor. In this scenario, Riley's firm IS participating in the distribution. They are officially an underwriter. They're getting paid to sell the deal.
Uh-oh. So they are officially standing in the lava.
Yes, but they can stand on this specific couch. IF, the research report, covers a totally different class of securities than the ones they are actively distributing.
Walk me through a concrete example.
Let's say the registered offering is for the issuer's common stock. Equity, high risk, voting rights. Riley's firm is the lead underwriter for that common stock IPO. Riley's research department can legally publish a report, provided that the report relates solely to the issuer's non-convertible debt or their non-convertible non-participating preferred stock.
Let's break that jargon down. Non-convertible debt, you mean just standard bonds. They pay a yield, you don't get a vote, and you can't magically trade them in for common stock later.
Exactly. They are fundamentally different sides of the capital structure. If you are writing a research report analyzing the safety of a company's debt, you are not inherently hyping up the explosive growth potential of their equity.
And vice versa, right?
Yeah.
Like, they could be underwriting a massive bond issuance while the research department publishes a report strictly on the common stock.
Correct. The absolute key is that one side is common stock or debt that is convertible into common stock, and the other side is strictly non-convertible debt or a non-participating preferred stock. The two sides must be cleanly, mathematically separated so that hyping one doesn't automatically juice the price of the other.
Okay, but because Riley's firm, IS, actively participating in the deal this time, they have a massive conflict of interest. Does the SEC require anything extra from the issuer to allow this?
Yes. Because the broker-dealer is inside the tent, the SEC demands more transparency from the company. The issuer must have filed all of their Exchange Act periodic reports, their 10-Ks, their 10-Qs, that were required during the preceding 12 months. They have to be fully current on their SEC homework.
And what is the legal mechanism here? Does this one also say Riley's firm isn't an underwriter?
No. Think about it. Riley's firm is an underwriter in this scenario. They signed the contract, so the rule cannot say they aren't one. Instead, the different class safe harbor shifts its focus to the document itself. It states that the research report is not an offer for sale or an offer to sell.
I guarantee this is a trap on the exam. Do not mix up the legal mechanisms. The non-participant harbor protects you by modifying the underwriter definition. The different class harbor protect you by modifying the meaning of an offer. If a multiple choice question swaps those two rationales, you are looking at a wrong answer.
Absolutely. The examiners want to know if you understand how the shield works, not just that you have a shield.
Okay, let's go to the third, final, and most dangerous one, the continuing coverage safe harbor.
In this scenario, Riley's firm IS participating in the distribution, and the research report covers the exact same securities being distributed.
Wow. So they are the lead underwriter for the common stock. ND, the research department, is publishing a glowing report on that exact same common stock at the exact same time. That sounds like an astronomical conflict of interest. It sounds like a stealth advertisement. Why is this even legal?
It is only legal because the conditions for this specific safe harbor are draconian. The SEC recognizes that if a major Wall Street firm covers a blue chip company for a decade, forcing them to drop coverage just because they are underwriting a secondary offering would actually hurt the market by starving it of analysis. So they allow it, but with massive guardrails.
Let's hear the guardrails.
First, the legal mechanism is the same as the second harbor. It simply says the report is not an offer. But the added conditions are intense. Let's look at an issuer-specific report first. The publication cannot be an initiation of coverage.
So Riley can't say, hey, we just won the underwriting bid for Apple. Let's drop our very first research report on Apple tomorrow.
Never. That is a promotional push. Furthermore, it cannot be a restart of coverage after the firm had previously dropped it. The coverage must be ongoing and continuous. The firm must have already been covered the issuer in the regular course of its business long before this specific offering ever began.
What about the company itself? Do they have to be a certain size?
Yes. Because of the conflict of interest, the SEC only allows this for highly established companies. The issuer generally needs to meet the requirements to register securities on Form S-3 or F-3, which are the short-form registration statements. They have to meet minimum public float requirements or be a well-known seasoned issuer, a WKSI. Plus, they have to meet the current periodic reports condition we mentioned earlier.
So you can't use this for a tiny, unknown microcap company.
Exactly. The market needs to already have robust information about the company to counterbalance the underwriter's inherent bias.
What if it's not a report just about one company? What if Riley's firm publishes a massive industry report like the State of the Tech Sector 2026?
The bar is slightly lower for an industry report, but it has its own strict structural rules. The report has to cover a substantial number of issuers in the industry, or it has to contain a comprehensive list of all the securities the firm currently recommends.
And what's to stop Riley from writing a 50-page tech sector report where 49 pages are dedicated to the one specific company his firm is underwriting?
Well, the SEC thought of that. The rule explicitly states that the report cannot give the specific issuer any materially greater space or prominence than the others in the publication. It has to be treated proportionally.
What about projections, like sales or earnings projections? Do those count as part of the research?
Yes, a projection is a form of analysis, so it falls inside the research report definition. But if you are putting projections in an industry report under this continuing coverage safe harbor, you must meet three tests. One, you must already publish projections on a regular basis. Two, you must be currently publishing projections on this specific issuer. And three, the projections have to cover similar time periods for a substantial number of other issuers in the industry. You cannot selectively project massive earnings for your underwriting client while ignoring the rest of the sector.
Okay, I have one final, incredibly nuanced question on these research harbors. We shouted a warning earlier about how registered safe harbors cannot be used for private placements. But looking at the rules, there's a massive quirk regarding private resales.
Yes, there is a very specific, highly tested extension. Only the different class and the continuing coverage safe harbors extend to QIB private resales, which is Rule 144A and Regulation S offshore offerings.
Wait, why only those two? Why doesn't the non-participant harbor extend to private resales?
Think about the legal mechanics we just spent so much time breaking down. What do the different class and continuing coverage harbors do?
They modify the definition of an offer. They say the report is not an offer.
Exactly. That language translates perfectly to a private resale context. For a Rule 144A private resale, you cannot make a general solicitation. If the rule says your report is not an offer, then by definition, it cannot be a general solicitation. The shield fits perfectly.
Ah, and the non-participant one?
The non-participant harbor only answers one specific question. It keeps the firm out of the underwriter definition. It never says the report isn't an offer. So if Riley tries to use it in a private resale scenario, the SEC will say, congratulations, you aren't an underwriter. But you still just blasted an unregistered offer to the public, which is a general solicitation. You violated the exemption.
That is brilliant. The mechanics dictate the application. If you only memorize the list without understanding the why, that rule feels totally random. But when you realize it all hinges on the legal definition of an offer versus an underwriter, it clicks together like puzzle pieces.
Exactly. And one final warning on the non-participant safe harbor. Do not trick yourself into believing it provides blanket immunity from underwriter exposure. Removing that exposure is the active, fragile job of the safe harbor. The exact second Riley fails one of the conditions, say, he secretly accepts compensation from the issuer to write the report, the safe harbor vanishes, and the massive liability of being an underwriter comes crashing right back down on him.
All right, we have survived the research department. We are in the home stretch. Section 6, the final countdown, or as the SEC officially calls it, preceded by a prospectus.
Yeah, we have navigated the pre-filing announcements. We have marketed the funds. We have analyzed the research. Now the transaction is actually happening.
Let's bring Ingrid the investor back in for the finale. Let's say Ingrid owns stock in a major corporation, and that corporation is merging with a rival company. Because it's a major merger, Ingrid actually has to vote to approve it. When does she receive the actual physical or legally hyperlinked prospectus, does the SEC just care that she eventually gets it in the mail?
Not at all. Timing is everything here. The rule is literally titled preceded by a prospectus, and it covers very specific structural transactions,
yeah.
reclassifications of securities, mergers, consolidations, and transfers of assets.
Pause and look at what is not on that list.
Exactly. This timing rule only applies if the transaction requires a security holder vote or consent. If it is just a straightforward cash purchase of shares on the open market that doesn't need holder approval, this specific timing rule does not trigger. The voters are the ones who desperately need the disclosure document to make an informed decision.
So when exactly must the prospectus arrive?
It must reach the security holders before the vote on the transaction occurs. Or, if they are taking action by written consent without a formal meeting, it must reach them before the earliest date on which that corporate action could be taken.
And who exactly needs to receive it? What if Ingrid moved to a new house 3 months ago and never told a company?
The delivery must reach all security holders of record who are entitled to vote or consent. And the rule is highly specific about logistics. It must be sent to each holder's address of record on the corporation's transfer records.
So if the company mails it to her old address, because that is what the official transfer records say, the firm is still legally protected.
Yes. The safe harbor relies on the official transfer records, not just any last known address a broker might have scribbled on a napkin. The firm did its duty based on the official data.
You know, the best way to visualize this rule is to compare it to a local election ballot. Think about when you vote for a new mayor or a bond measure. The city mails you an information pamphlet explaining the ballot measures. It doesn't matter if you receive that pamphlet the day after Election Day, even if it arrives in pristine, perfect condition. If you didn't have the pamphlet in your hand before you walked into the voting booth, the democratic system failed you.
That is exactly how the SEC views corporate votes. The pre-vote prospectus delivery rule is not asking a logistical question about whether the post office eventually delivered the document. It is asking a philosophical question. Did every eligible voter have the required disclosures in hand before they cast a binding vote or before a consent action became irrevocable? Timing, not eventual completeness, is what the safe harbor tests.
Okay, take a deep breath.
That was a tremendous amount of lava to avoid.
It really was. We just navigated an absolute minefield of compliance traps. So let's do a quick vibe shift. Let's lock this knowledge in for test day. It is time for a rapid-fire survival guide. I'll throw out the concept. You give me the absolute essential testable takeaway. Ready?
Ready.
Electronic media and the general solicitation trap.
Treat a public website or an untargeted email blast exactly like a full-page newspaper ad. To avoid the trap, you need a pre-existing substantive relationship, meaning you actually gathered and analyzed financial data, not just relied on a checkbox. And portal order matters. Qualify first, open account second, view subsequent deals third.
Proposed offering notice.
Pre-filing. It's the save the date and never ever name the underwriter.
Tombstone communication.
Post-filing. It's the formal invitation. It is a strict closed list of 21 items. You can name the underwriters. It basically always needs a prospectus contact and it needs a pre-effective legend if the registration is not yet effective. And remember, open-end mutual funds cannot use this.
Generic advertising.
Vague TV commercials. Fund types only. No specific funds. You must identify the registered broker-dealer. And it does not help private placements because it fundamentally conditions the market.
Research harbors.
Three types. Must be published in the regular course of business. 3-year look-back ban for penny stocks and shells. Non-participant protects you by modifying the underwriter definition. Different class and continuing coverage protect you by modifying the definition of an offer. And only those last two extend to private resales and offshore deals.
Pre-vote prospectus.
Mergers and votes only. Delivery must be to the address of record before the vote or consent happens. Timing is everything.
Boom. Nailed it. Before we sign off, I want to leave you with one final provocative thought. We've thrown a massive list of rules, safe harbors, and tiny couches at you today. It can feel overwhelming, but...
But if you step back, you can see the underlying philosophy of the SEC woven across every single one of these rules. The SEC doesn't just care about what words you use. They care entirely about your timing, your audience, and your intent. The SEC is constantly asking, Are you trying to use a technical loophole to bypass the spirit of the law?
Exactly.
Whether it's Riley initiating a brand new research report right before a deal to act as a stealth advertisement, or Sam using a generic television commercial to warm up the crowd for an unregistered private placement, the SEC's rules are meticulously engineered to detect your true intent based on your historical behavior. As you study for the Series 82, whenever you encounter a safe harbor, don't just blindly memorize the list of permitted items. Stop and ask yourself, what specific sneaky behavior is the SEC actively trying to prevent here? If you understand the fear behind the rule, you will always remember the rule itself.
The floor really is lava, and the SEC is the one controlling the thermostat. Keep your intent clean, know your timing, understand the mechanics, and you'll stay safely on the couch. Good luck studying for the Series 82. You've got this. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.